You're listening to a recording of the Boston Symphony Orchestra's 2005 performance of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Now, 124 years earlier, inspired in part by his love for Beethoven, Henry Lee Higginson placed the following announcement in Boston newspapers. Quote, "Notwithstanding the development of musical taste in Boston, we have never yet possessed a full and permanent orchestra, offering the best music at low prices, such as may be found in all the large European cities. To obviate this difficulty, the following plan is offered. The intention is that this orchestra shall be made permanent here, and shall be called the Boston Symphony Orchestra." And thus was founded one of the most beloved cultural institutions in the world. But for its founder, Henry Lee Higginson, the creation of the BSO was more than a musical effort. It was a profoundly moral one. Music historian Joseph Horowitz tells the story in his wonderful new book, Moral Fire: Musical Portraits from America's Fin de Siècle. Joseph Horowitz, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi. Glad to be here.
I really, really enjoyed reading your book. There's so much to be told about Henry Lee Higginson, but I wonder if we might start in 1864 in a letter to Higginson from Charles Russell Lowell. And you quote part of the letter, if I just might read it for people here. Lowell writes to Henry Lee Higginson, again, this is 1864, so Civil War. Lowell writes, "All I care about is to be a useful citizen, with money enough to buy my bread and firewood, to teach my children how to ride on horseback, and look strangers in the face, especially Southern strangers." So this idea of being a useful citizen, why is it so important in the foundation story of the Boston Symphony Orchestra?
Well, Higginson is a colossal example of a useful citizen. He's a man who was not born to wealth. He wasn't even born in Boston, although he was born to a prominent Boston family. And he was a music lover, so he went to Vienna to become a musician. He couldn't afford to feed himself three times a day. He discovered that he didn't have the talent to be an important musician, and that's when he formulated his life's ambition, which was to create a world-class orchestra for the city of Boston, which meant amassing enough money to make that happen, which is why he became a banker. He joined the family business. And at the moment that he found he had amassed sufficient capital, he placed the announcement in 1881 that you just read.
Mm. You know, but there's so much that intercedes between that 1881 moment and right. You know, his childhood growing up in New York and then coming to, or as to say, going to Boston Latin School and Harvard. I do want to explore for another couple minutes, if we could, this idea of his experience in the Civil War, because he takes a bullet in the back, a saber cuts across his face. I mean, it's harrowing.
He's left for dead. In fact, he persuades a Confederate soldier to leave him alone because he's going to die anyway, but he doesn't. And he's nursed by his father. He has an exceptionally close relationship with his father. This story goes in so many directions. The fact that he served in the Civil War. Higginson did not live in a small Brahmin world. Higginson was part of a big international and civic community, and his range of acquaintances was such that he might deal with Morgan and Vanderbilt one day and then have dinner with Henry James, whom he called Harry, the next. And this range of acquaintance combined with his temperament, one of the most startling things that was ever said about him by a man named Bliss Perry, who was his biographer, is that to his true comrades, Higginson was like a lover. Higginson's temperament as a friend was exceptionally warm and even intimate. Mm. So he violates stereotypes of the Boston Brahmin, stereotypes of the late Gilded Age in every direction. And unfortunately, he has himself been stereotyped. And one of the reasons that I write about him is to redress the literature, which perceives him as an autocrat and a robber baron. He's a case of a man of the most exceptional, almost incomprehensible generosity.
Well, and you do so very beautifully, in part by letting Higginson's own words speak for themselves, because, you know, as you're saying, while he violates all these stereotypes of the insular, Bostonian Brahmin, he's also, in a certain sense, the apotheosis of some of the highest thinking of the late 19th century. I mean, you quote a letter from him that he writes in 1862, regarding why he's in the Civil War fighting for the Union, he says, "We are fighting against slavery, present or future, and we are struggling for the right of mankind to be educated and to think." And his letters are full of lines like that.
He's a prodigious moral force. He ran a plantation in Georgia for freedmen, for freed slaves, after the Civil War. That's just a typical twist in the career of Higginson. And when he founded the Boston Symphony, if you had read the rest of the announcement, you would have read the importance of 25-cent tickets, which is to say that the public rehearsals, which were really concerts, were ticketed at 25 cents, and then even for the concerts, he set aside, as a matter of policy, non-subscription tickets at 25 cents, which even in 1881 was a small sum of money. So the part of Higginson that was a Democrat was a huge part of Higginson. This is less than the ticket prices in Chicago and New York and for the other Boston orchestras. And these ticket prices were resented by some and described as a ploy to drive the other orchestras out of business. The Boston Symphony did drive out of business the orchestra of the Harvard Musical Association, but that was not the only reason. It was also just a far better orchestra.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm just so curious to hear a little bit more about your thinking as to why it was that music was the vehicle through which Henry Lee Higginson exercised this small d Democrat in him, this sense of being trying to be a useful citizen, of music as a moral force.
Well, the book I wrote, Moral Fire, which comprises mainly four portraits, one of which is of Higginson, is a book about the once widespread belief that culture, or say high culture, is inherently morally empowering. This sounds today like a musty Victorian idea, partly because of the example of the music lovers Hitler and Stalin, who appropriated, you know, Wagner and Beethoven and Mozart. But I think it's an idea that still has merit and can still serve to inspire. So it was Higginson's belief that a Beethoven symphony was morally fibered, and that those of us who were acquainted with Beethoven would be made better people. He is an embodiment of that himself, and I think it's a sentiment that should be taken seriously in itself, and it also explains the passion that drove his creation of a symphony orchestra for Boston. Well, not everyone depicts Higginson in this light. There's a school of historians that see the cultural institutions of the late Gilded Age as instruments of control. And if you were to juxtapose Higginson with John Sullivan Dwight, who was active at the Harvard Musical Association, you'd see two very different versions of the same thing. Mm. Dwight was a snob and an elitist. And for him, culture was partly a way to keep the Irish rabble at bay. That's everything that Higginson, as a culture bearer and a believer in culture, was not.
And it's fascinating to me because Henry Lee Higginson also distinguished himself by, for lack of a better way to put it, putting his money where his mouth was. I mean, he paid for the BSO, and I mean, he's the reason why we have Boston Symphony Hall.
You have to realize that there was no board of directors for the Boston Symphony between 1881 and 1918. There was just one guy who invented it, owned it, and operated it. He paid all the salaries. He hired and fired the conductors. He built the hall. It's all coming out of his pocket, and he had hoped to leave an endowment. In fact, he was afraid that upon his death the orchestra would die because he had not been able to do so. Of course, as soon as he resigned, a board of directors quickly materialized. But this was his own orchestra.
His own orchestra, and as you hinted or said a little earlier, Symphony Hall itself is maybe perhaps the most lasting physical embodiment of Higginson's vision of being a useful citizen.
You can read Higginson in the Symphony Hall in many ways. The fact that there are no boxes is the most obvious. This is a hall that doesn't stratify its audience. It also feels, I would say, like a church. And another interesting feature of the hall is its blank surfaces where there were supposed to be inscriptions on the outside. Higginson never got around to that. He certainly didn't want it to be called Higginson Hall. He wasn't interested in emblazoning his name on the hall, and yet the hall does embody the severity of Higginson, the passion of Higginson, the very personality of Higginson, I would say, is structured into that building.
We've just got a few seconds to go here before the end of the program, but I do have to ask you, you're a musical historian, you're a historian, you've really brought to life this chapter of Boston history in your book in a way that thrilled me, but I have to wonder about when you cast your eye about the scene today, do you see Higginson's spirit alive and well in how we engage with our city today?
I have a book called Classical Music in America, which attempts to tell the story of the whole trajectory. And one of the themes of the book, sadly, is that individuals of great vision seem to cluster at the end of the 19th century. There are people like Oscar Hammerstein, who created the Manhattan Opera, or Theodore Thomas, who created a touring orchestra, or Jeanette Thurber, who created the National Conservatory and hired Dvorak to be its director. If you're looking for short answers to this question, I would have to say that there are no Henry Higginsons to name.
Well, Joseph Horowitz is author of Moral Fire, Musical Portraits from America's Fin de Siècle. It is a beyond delightful read. He tells in one of the chapters the story of Henry Lee Higginson, founder of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Joseph Horowitz, thank you so much for your book and thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
And listeners, we're going to go out on Beethoven's Third Symphony because Joseph Horowitz quotes a letter that Henry Lee Higginson wrote about this symphony, where Higginson writes, "I had meant to tell you how I felt about it, but it opens the floodgates and I can't. No words are of any avail, and never does that passage of entire relief and joy come to me without tears. I wait for it through life and I hear it and wonder." This is the BSO's Third, or Beethoven's Third by the BSO. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.